This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Just yesterday, North Carolina reported its largest daily increase in COVID-19 cases, and the case count still reflects stark racial disparities. African Americans make up about 22% of the state population, but data from NCDHHS shows they account for almost a quarter of cases and a third of deaths. In light of these statistics, how is North Carolina's Black community coping with this moment? Leonita Inge is WUNC's race and Southern culture reporter. She's also one of the hosts of WUNC's podcast, Tested. She joins me now. Leonita, welcome back to the show.
Hi there, Anita.
So we talked about the data. It paints a really stark picture, but it does lack some context about what this has meant for the lives of Black individuals and families and family structure. And you've done a lot of reporting on a few aspects of Black family life that have really been shaped by the pandemic. So tell me a bit about your reporting and what you've uncovered.
Well, one thing, I think in the past 3 months or so, I've heard some clear, I guess, in concise commentary on this topic, because as the numbers begin to surface, showing how African Americans, you know, at the rate that they're contracting the coronavirus and dying of COVID-19, everybody in the world seems to all of a sudden want to know, like, why, you know, how is this happening? And, I was born in the 1960s in Mobile, Alabama, in a segregated hospital. And I belong to, I guess, family, and several of them are health professionals who have, like, worked all their lives to improve the quality of health for Black people, who for generations have really been denied access to health care, to good health care. So I'm not ignoring, when I say this, the fact that a high percentage of Black people live near or below the poverty line. And in states like North Carolina, who, you know, this state has not expanded Medicaid. And so some would say that means that, you know, that's a way of not ensuring that some of the neediest people even have health insurance. But when you see a poll that I wrote about not too long ago that was released by, like, the NAACP, the Yale School of Medicine, the African American Research Collaborative, you know, it shows that Black people really feel they are less likely than whites to even be tested for the coronavirus, for example. They feel that they're less likely to be admitted even to the hospital for the virus or even given experimental drugs, you know, to fight the pandemic. So remember, these are people who more often than not maybe live in high-density housing, you know, have to use public transportation. They don't have the luxury, like you and I, to social distance as much, you know, and work from home. So, you know, if there's any group of people that would possibly be exposed to the coronavirus at a very high rate, it's the people who continue to cook and clean for all of us and keep this nation moving. And those happen to be people of color.
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned so much in there that kind of illuminates, obviously, links between systemic racism and COVID-19, how it's baked into our healthcare system in terms of racial disparities and treatment and access to care. And then, I mean, you really point to this question of trust, you know, is how am I going to be treated if I do go to get a test done? How am I going to be treated if I do end up in the hospital? And trust is this issue that comes up again and again in your reporting. You did speak with someone from the North Carolina Division of Public Health about trust, and she told you that, you know, they are working on it. They are trying. Tell me a bit more about what you heard from Dr. Cardra Burns.
Well, the first thing that Dr. Cardra Burns told me is that she wanted to make sure that, you know, she wanted to let me know that she was an African-American woman, and this was very important to her, that people who look like her were taken care of, especially during this time. And she says one of her main jobs is to reduce some of the systemic barriers, you know, creating these health disparities like access and implicit bias and, of course, testing, which now seems to have been magnified, you know, during this pandemic. And in coming days, she actually says she hopes to, you know, that everything will be in place to bolster testing, you know, on the ground with some of their partners like Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, And she's hoping that that will definitely help the situation. She says it's like very important. We go back to trust. She says she wants to make sure that the community messengers, you know, and those, the voices on the ground are trusted by the people. They have really been tasked to serve. And that also includes, she says, debunking a lot of myths, like, you know, if you get tested for COVID, you will get COVID. She says, you know, they're working to make sure people don't and hopefully do not believe that. I guess another myth is if you test negative for COVID-19, you won't get COVID. And that's not true either. You know, these tests are just like one moment in time. And she says it's going to take a lot of trust, love, and education, you know, to finally do right by this population.
Going to where the people are, making sure you're going to spaces where people already feel safe. And you made your debut
like I
on
said,
the...
taking it to the street, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You made your debut on the Tested podcast last Friday. And one of the things that you said that really stood with me was that 1 in 3 Black people know someone who has died of COVID-19. I mean, that is a really alarming statistic. And I wonder, I mean, as you've thought about that, what has that meant for Black families in North Carolina, in the country, to experience death and proximity to death at that rate?
Well, I definitely know people and have friends, a friend in Durham, North Carolina, whose father died from complications of COVID. I mean, everybody I know of color knows somebody, even the one of the lead musicians at my uncle's church in Mobile, Alabama, passed away of COVID. I mean, it's just conversation that comes up every day. You know, I even have relatives, they go straight to the newspaper, you know, just to see who is listed in the obituary section. You know, one thing I definitely have noticed when I speak to family, friends, you know, preachers, teachers, you know, health experts, is like any other race of people, Black people do not want to die from COVID-19. They do not want to be the face of this pandemic that it seems to be happening. And I think about the time that I spent with a Durham-based funeral home director, you know, a fourth-generation funeral director in the middle of an African-American community in Durham, and just listening to her talk about all the ways, you know, she's actually trying to make sure the Black, mostly Black families that she serves are just as comfortable as they can in saying goodbye to their loved ones. Because, you know, in a way I even feel, you know, we have this disproportionately high rate of people dying. That means, you know, please, you know, let us be able to say goodbye. My uncles, you know, like in the Black community, funerals are like family reunions. You know, they're big, loving, full of food, celebration, all of that. And my uncle, one of my uncle, he calls them, of course, funeral reunions. They just call them funeral reunions. But, you know, those aren't supposed to be happening right now like that. And it's been very hard on people. I think the CDC's even called some Black funerals super spreaders, you know, of the coronavirus. You go there to say goodbye, and then people are dying, you know, people are contracting the virus. So, I mean, I have a mother who's ill, who's deathly ill, and I tried to keep my distance for as long as possible, and that's why I'm in Florida right now. It's like, I'm going to see my mother. Sorry. You know, maybe I won't be able to see or go back in the office for a long time, but I don't know.
Well, you're still doing lots
of emotional times for me and a lot of people that I know.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all of your reporting. And you can hear more about Leonida's feature on the funeral home in Durham, as well as her experience reporting from Florida. All of it at our website, stateofthings.org, where you can also find the Tested podcast that she's going to be hosting each Friday. Leonida, thanks so much, and sending all our best to your family.
Thank you very much.
I want to turn now to another reporter who has spent time with North Carolina's Latinx community. Hispanic-identifying people in the state account for close to half of reported COVID-19 cases, although they make up less than 10% of the state's population. Victoria Bulubasis joins me now to share her reporting on that disparity. She's an independent journalist whose work on the pandemic has appeared in Enlace Latino NC and North Carolina Health News. Victoria, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Anita. Thank you.
Of course. So as we spoke with Leonid, I mean, there are a lot of systemic barriers within the healthcare system that lead to this disparate impact. But take me into the Latinx community in particular in North Carolina and some of the other reasons behind the disparate impact of COVID-19 cases.
Sure. Well, you know, as you mentioned, the COVID cases are currently at 46% of them being within the Latinx community, but that's only what's been documented. You know, the state isn't required and the counties aren't required to report ethnicity. So, you know, there's about 45,000 cases where ethnicity has been reported, and almost 21,000 of them are the Latinx community. And that's just what we know. So, you know, the disparity exists in the reporting, first off.
So as you've been going and looking at these disparities, you have been really looking at particular outbreaks in spaces like meatpacking plants, which employ large numbers of the state's Latino population. And we know that there's not a lot of transparency about the numbers of cases in particular plants. But I'd love to hear, I mean, what does this mean? What does this lack of access to information and these high case numbers mean for the lives of workers and their families? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, as with most things, the pandemic is obviously exacerbating problems that have already existed. And that's really, that's being unveiled in the food and agriculture industry in particular, where the essential workforce is predominantly people of color. Those workers that I've talked to are actually mostly Latina women. So they're mothers and grandmothers who, you know, have to figure out how to get back to their families and keep them safe while also staying safe at work. You know, a lot of the issues were that early on there was not enough protective equipment on the job, and so women were making masks and selling them really cheap to their colleagues on the plant floor. I've heard of cases where they were not permitted to do that after a certain time, and then they weren't given protective equipment until much, much later. So I think there's been sort of a tardiness in approaching the problem and workers. So that's one thing. And I think, too, when we are talking about workers, a lot of the framing in media through official communication has been very much on the fact that they're workers and forgetting that, you know, these are residents in our communities and they have greater communities, whether it be through churches or through their own extended families.
Has the state done anything to engage with these populations and address the disparities in particular for Latinx communities?
I think there's a difference between the engagement and addressing the issues head on. The state still will not name the meatpacking plants. And so workers are dependent on supervisors and employers who are not being transparent with them. And the state has not done anything to help that situation. Last week, DHHS did give out 5 grants to Latino organizations. They gave out $100,000 to each of those groups, but it's unclear how the money will be used. And my understanding is that this happened without a public request for proposals. So again, that process wasn't transparent, and we're hoping to learn more soon as far as, you know, how that money will be used to actually address the community and these inequities. But there has been, you know, a task force put on by Dr. Viviana Bianchi at Duke, where there are Latino, and I would say mostly Latino women, doctors and other community stakeholders involved since March in trying to address these issues and you know, slowly work with the state.
How about access to information? We've talked a few times during this pandemic about Enlace Latino, the organization you're working for, and their really wonderful attempts to diversify the kinds of content they're providing, use WhatsApp, create a podcast to make sure they're getting content to Spanish-speaking individuals in this state. I mean, do you feel like individuals feel served by institutions and journalism in terms of access to information?
Yeah, that's something hard to determine. Enlace Latino NC and my editor, Paula Jaramillo, have been doing an amazing job updating the figures nearly every day. Like you said, there's a WhatsApp group. I think what's been interesting is there's more bilingual content. It's great for me as a journalist because I often work in communities where I'm reporting in Spanish, but then I'm publishing in English, whereas now My sources are able to read exactly how their story is being presented in their own language. And I'm hearing too, and Paola has been hearing as well, that in a lot of the immigrant families where there's sort of mixed language use, like a mother and her son, for example, her first-gen American son can read the same story and discuss the issue in ways that they both understand. So that's been really interesting. And I think part of that too is the sort of collaboration in journalism that's been spurred by the pandemic. A lot of my work is co-published with nonprofit news sites like Southerly or NC Health News, and I know the News and Observer has picked it up as well. So as far as accessing the particular community, I think the reporting has been effective from what we can tell, but I still think there are issues, you know, on the state level of accessing folks in culturally sensitive ways, giving information on time. There's still some issues there.
One of those reporting partnerships led to a profile that you did of the only child to die in North Carolina during the pandemic, Yoshi, an 8-year-old. I would love to end by just hearing a bit more about Yoshi and her family and the story that you reported.
Sure. That was obviously an incredibly difficult story to report, only because it's unimaginable to lose a child this way or anyway. And it is very uncommon, you know, for the coronavirus to have such severe effects in children and for such an outcome. Yoshi was 8 years old. She was a second grader at Creekside Elementary School. The way I accessed finding that family was because I had multiple friends who knew them through their own children. And, you know, I think their family represents a lot of the issues faced by the Latinx community. A family friend started a GoFundMe because they could not continue, one, paying these hospital bills, but also their rent. Everyone in the family got the coronavirus. Yoshi was the only one who experienced these horrible symptoms. Her father is an essential worker, so he's an electrician in construction. His hours had been reduced, so, you know, they're already, you know, representing an essential workforce. And then language justice came up in every interview I had with Yoshi's mother, Araceli Morales Martinez. She talked about there being just, you know, it was a very traumatic few days in the hospital as her daughter slipped into a coma and then died. They did have an interpreter there, but they were not communicated with afterward. I have not been able to find an autopsy through the state. The hospital, of course, won't give me that information, but the parents have no idea, you know, when any of those results may be coming back. They're still unclear how this happened to their daughter. And a lot of that has to do with the miscommunication and not being cared for, you know, post her death.
As we talked about with Leonita, I mean, obviously what comes up in Yoshi's story too, and a lot of your reporting is this question of trust. And I would love to end just in 30 seconds. I guess, what have you learned about the importance of trust in this moment when people are feeling so fragile and vulnerable and afraid?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. It's very important in listening to Leonita. A lot of these families have experienced trauma. I've heard from religious leaders and healthcare professionals that the parents don't want to go to the hospital because they don't want to leave their children at home. They have trauma with deportations in their community. There's, you know, issues with separation. And so that trust really parlays into that. A lot of them are undocumented and don't want to show their identification and be, you know, documented in the system that they're not sure could, you know, help them or harm them later on.
A lot more to find in your reporting. Victoria Bulubeses is an independent journalist and an investigative reporter with Enlace Latino NC. You can find links to her reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Victoria, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anita.